This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل وسلم وبارك على سيدنا وحبيبنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين وبعد كل عام وانتم بخير. First of all, نعاد عليكم بالصحة والسلامة. Inshallah, next year everyone will be on Arafat making Hajj, inshallah, with their families. Glad to see you all. So we're going to continue, inshallah, from where we left off. بإذن الله تعالى, today we'll finish باب الطهارات. Or Bab al-Tahara, which is, you know, the chapter of purifications regarding waters and how to make wudu and how to make tayammum, how to do ghusl, and what's najis and what's pure, religiously pure, and what is religiously impure, and how these impurities and purities work with one another. Now, today there will be a lot of comparative fiqh. Whether I like it or not, the issues that are going to come up today are going to be a bit... prickly and difficult. People are going to have a lot of questions. So I don't have to answer a million questions. I will just myself explain, inshallah, each and every concept or topic that comes up that has more than one opinion regarding it, inshallah, to make it easier. Now, where we stopped off last time was, I'm not sure. It's ولا يعفى عن شيء من النجاسات. That's where we stopped off last time. I'm not sure which page it is on your. You find it? ولا يعفى. Yeah, keep on going a bit. So it's page 25. Is that 25 there?
25.
So page 25, right in the middle, it says ولا يعفى عن شيء من النجاسات. No, I have it here. إلا اليسير من الدم والقيح. And then nothing from the impurities from najasat. Anything najis is impure. Examples would be urine, feces, blood, pus, right? These are impure substances. ولا يعفى means none of them, no amount of impure substances are forgiven when it comes on your clothing or on your body in order for you to be able to pray. In order for you to be able to pray, to perform salah, you need not to have any najasat on you as well. So you have to have purification or purity by performing wudu or ghusl, but you can't pray with urine on you, right? So what this sentence is saying is that there is no amount of... there's no amount of impure substances that are forgiven except al-yasir, except very, very small amounts from dam and qayh, from both blood and pus, right? وَمَا لَا نَفْسَ لَهُ سَائِلَةٌ, and I'll explain that in a second. And living things that do not have amounts of blood in them, like insects. وَمَا لَا نَفْسَ لَهُ سَائِلَةٌ, meaning nafs, a spirit. Sa'ila means that has fluid in it, that has blood in it. So this is basically talking about insects, different types of insects. إِذَا وَقَعَ فِي الْإِنَاءِ وَمَاتَ فِيهِ فَإِنَّهُ لَا يُنَجِّسُهُ. If an insect falls into a jug of water and dies in it, it doesn't turn that jug of water to najis. I mean, the water is not najis. So if there's a dead fly in water, you just throw it out. If there's a dead cockroach, you know, you throw it out, you can still use it for wudu at least. So you don't have to get rid of it, you don't have to throw it out.
Do you have any references for that? Water, plus, so where did that come from?
Okay, so this is where they differ on a really big matter. The Shafi'iyya, which is what we're studying right now, they will forgive small amounts of blood and pus, specifically, if it is smaller than a dirham baghli. So it's a reference, an old reference of a type of a coin, but basically this big. So if the spot is less than this for the Shafi'iyya of blood or pus, then that is ma'fi anhu, you can pray. For the Hanafiyya, that is complete. If less than a quarter of your garment, less than a quarter of your garment has blood and pus, you can still pray. More than a quarter, you can't. So the Hanafiyya have a bigger margin. The Hanabila and Malikiyya don't accept that at all. They don't forgive any amount of blood and pus at all. Yes.
Is it the quarter of a limb of the garment or any garment?
The whole garment, and they differ on that hugely. So don't ask me about the difference, because they really differ within the Madhab Hanafi. They differ on what they mean by garment and how big a garment can be and how much it can be. But that's their general ruling, that it's less than a quarter or a third, then they're okay with you praying with it. But with a lot of differences within the Madhab itself. The Malikiyya and the Hanabila, they don't forgive any amount of dam qayh, of blood and pus, urine and feces at all. So if it's there, you have to get rid of it, even if you're not sure, even if you can't see it. Now the Shafi'iyya, regarding urine and feces, they forgive anything that is not visible, that you can't see. If you can't see it, then it's forgiven. Right? It has nothing to do, well, what would happen if the color of the, if I'm wearing something yellow and there's urine on it so I can't see the color? No. Meaning that if it was a different color and the drop of urine that's there is so small that you can't see it with your eyes, right? Then that is forgiven for the Shafi'iyya. For the Hanafiyya, right? They are okay with a dirham baghli as well. So the Hanafiyya, when it comes, they have a larger margin. So if you have urine and feces less than a coin size, then you can pray with that. So they forgive a larger amount of urine and feces if they're on your garments.
If that were to come from you, as in the
no. So let's say So let's say that you're walking in and someone splashes urine on you, right? So if it's less than a coin size for the Hanafiyya, you can pray. You don't have to do anything, right? For the Shafi'iyya, if you can see, you have to remove it, right? For the Hanabila, even if you can't see it, you know that you were sprayed, but you can't see it, you still have to go clean the garment. So let's say you're walking and you're sprayed by najasa, right? For the Hanafiyya, as long as it's smaller than a coin, it didn't make a spot bigger than a coin, or all the accumulative spots don't make something bigger than a coin, then you can pray. For the Shafi'iyya, if you can see it, you have to remove it, right? You're only forgiven for something you can't see. For the Hanabila, if you're sprayed, right, and then you look, you know that you're sprayed, but you can't see anything, you still have to clean the garment all over again. Yes.
So my question is, like, if a drop of pee comes out of you, that's the size of that would
good. Now I'll come to that in a second. That's what the point of doing this today.
And I'm assuming that for the quarter, that's for, like, other than urine and feces, so like blood.
Blood and pus, which is basically what we talked about at the beginning. So blood and pus for the Shafi'iyya, as much as a coin is acceptable, more than that, no. For the Hanafiyya, if it's a quarter, as long as it's less than a quarter of your garment. The Maliki and Hanabi are very strict on the existence of any types of najasat on your garments, and they're very difficult on that. But regardless, it's just how it is, how they view it. Now, the point that needs to be brought up is dribbling. That happens commonly, to men, and sometimes to older women, which is dribbling after you go to the bathroom. Now, after you go to the bathroom, as long as you put in the effort to try and empty the urethra from urine, then you've done your job. If anything comes out, right, as long as it's smaller than a dirham, for the Hanafiyya you're fine. For the Shafi'i, as long as it's not seen, something that can't be unseen. But you're not required to put in extra effort to rid yourself of urine or feces. So Islamically speaking, there is no evidence that you need to do anything specific in trying to get rid of your. So you're up, sitting up and down and which is good. You can do that if you know that it works for you. But you're not required to do that. You just need to, with a simple stroke, to push out whatever is left. Anything that comes out after that, as long as it's less than that amount for the Hanafiyya, then you're fine. Because this is not actually urinating. This is just something you can't. هذا لا يمكن الاحتراز عنه. It's called something you cannot dodge. It's just the fact of how we exist. For the Shafi'i, if it's visible, you have to clean it off. Yeah.
And by cleaning it, do you actually have to, like, wring it out, or can you just put water through it?
So you can't just sprinkle water, you have to actually rub it with water. So you have to, like, take some water and then rub it with water once or twice and then wash your hands. So that's how you get rid of it.
But you don't have to actually
So you don't have to rinse it. You don't have to rinse it out, no. But you can't just spray water on it. That's not enough. You actually have to kind of rub it with your hands. Okay? So that's, I know, it's. I'm sorry, but it is what it is. This is regarding a problem that is quite common, which is after you go to the bathroom, sometimes you feel that something may have come out, right? You're not sure of it. You don't need to be sure of it. It's fine. If this is no problem. And even if you do find something later, as long as it's less than a coin, then you're, for the Hanafi, you're still good. And I would take that rukhsa. I would take that fatwa for this, because it's just, especially today, I think there's a lot of changes onto the human biology today, and this is more common than it ever was. Well, I think one of the reasons is the fact that we don't go to the bathroom on old Arabic bathrooms, which is, of course, the difference if coming from an Arabic country or an Indian country or Pakistan or any of those, Eastern countries, our countries. We don't sit down like kings to go to the bathroom as we do here, and then do it in, mashallah, clean and pure water. Sometimes we go to the bathroom, subhanAllah, you should think about that. We do our business in water that is cleaner than most people around the world drink. يعني understand that, yeah, this is it's a subhanallah it's a يعني I don't know ربنا يغفر لنا but in different parts of the world they sit down right so when you sit down actually the pressure is higher so you get rid of more urine and more feces from your system and it's less likely for you to dribble but the problem is it's not enough to do that once or twice it has to be a habit it's how you're supposed to go to the bathroom long term so you don't end up with that little dribbling but for the Hanafiya as long as it's less than a coin then you're good to pray regardless for the Shafi'iyya it's a matter of something is it visible or is it not visible you are not required to put in too much effort into trying to empty the urethra as long as you've tried you've done the normal yani stroke then you're good and then you can get up and you can do your thing but you should wait if you know that there's something coming like if you know that it takes you once or twice especially for elderly men who need to, when they go to the bathroom it takes some time for them to get rid of the flow of urine then they should be a bit more patient when they're doing that yes go ahead
so, Sheikh, what about repeating wudu in this case
What do you mean?
No. He's talking about a person who, like, throughout the day, it happens to him.
Yeah, no. So you don't have to repeat wudu. No, and that's the Hanafiya again, right? So the Hanabi and Maliki don't accept that. So they're much more strict on the issue. I don't think I've because this issue is not common. So you don't find it in the books of fiqh word for word. I had to actually come up with these answers. We had to ask like back in the day, we had to ask actual scholars who were living to tell us what the madhab looked at it. Most current scholars today don't have a problem with the dribbling, especially when the amount is very small. Especially when you have no control over it. They do give an example of maybe putting a tissue or something so that if anything comes out it soaks into the tissue not into your clothing and then you throw it out before you pray there's a few ideas that they have but generally speaking I'm just giving you the basic idea as long as it's smaller than a certain amount then you're good inshallah to pray
I think a lot of them they just say that like if it's time for prayer make the wudu and yeah. then like if you lose it in the process
it's fine yeah praying. Exactly so some of them when if you're someone who has a issue of incontinency in of urine you can't hold it then you should make wudu before every prayer right even if you didn't go to the bathroom just make wudu every prayer before every prayer that is an idea yes what can I do for you
remember the secret I told you
yeah.
I was so important
yeah
the one when I what's the one when I did that what the Quran says the one so after me
yeah
loved me said remember
yeah
want to say it to the guys
maybe next time inshallah thank you so much but I will that's so nice of you jazakallah khair all right so the next so that is regarding what is forgiven from amounts of najasat all right so for blood and pus for the Shafi'i as long as it's less than a coin and for urine and feces which is najasa mughallada which is a higher level of impurity then it has to be something unseen لا يدركه الطرف meaning it cannot be seen but if it can be seen it has to be removed for the Hanafiya they have a different they have a larger margin for blood and pus as long as it's not a quarter of the garment and for urine and feces as long as lesser than a coin yeah.
So for blood and pus if it dries
yeah.
is it more encouraged not to wear that clothing anymore
no just yeah just oh I mean after you wash it out yeah you're fine no you don't need to do anything
so
yeah
you can still wear
yeah you can yeah definitely that goes for underwear as well I know again not the nicest thing to talk about but if you're wearing underwear for a long time and you wash it quite commonly but if there's any stains in it that you wear it you're fine like there's no reason for you to to get rid of it or get something new of course get rid of it and get something new if you can afford it but if not then you can still pray with that no problem at all okay yes after washing it of course okay is that to answer the yeah
by pus you mean like the white pus
yeah the white pus yeah
what about the clear pus
either way
Pus,
so it's not called pus. Pus is never clear. If it's clear, then it's not pus. It's a fluid. It's just an accumulation of fluid. It's not actually pus.
Yeah, like pimples.
Yeah. So pimples is usually not, pus has to have some white element or some has to be frothy. It has to be frothy. If it, again, this is not the yeah. But if it's fluid and it's then it's water or and it's not it does it's not considered as pus at all. Especially if you have a burn. Let's say you have a burn, so it kind of it doesn't turn into white pus at the beginning. It just turns into like a little bubble of water. So that's not seen as blood or pus. All right, JazakAllah khair. Okay, then we move on to the point after that. This is just to explain what is okay when it comes to the impurities on clothing or on yourself. What amounts are okay and what amounts are not okay. Wal hayawanu kulluhu tahir, and all animals are pure. All animals are pure during their lives. While they are alive. This is talking about something that is alive and breathing, right? Death is a different thing. So, وَالْحَيَوَانُ كُلُّهُ طَاهِرٌ Now, whenever you'll find for the Shafi'i, yes?
Except for God.
Yes, so, of course. Yeah. So, for the Shafi'iyya, every time that comes up, the Shafi'iyya will immediately say, إِلَّا الْكَلْبُ وَالْخِنْزِيرُ So the, for the Shafi'i, everything is pure except the canine and the boar or the pig. Yes.
And then for the Shafi'i, is it every part of the animal?
Yeah. So for the Shafi'i, وما تولد منهما أو من أحدهما, and everything that is born from them or from one of them. So let's say that there's interracial marriages within the animal kingdom, like there is between donkeys and mules and horses and whatnot. So if there's something like that for dogs or for boars, then anything that comes from one of them is going to be najis for the Shafi'iyya as well. Their bodies are najis, and their lu'ab is also najis. Their saliva is najis for the Shafi'iyya, right? Now, I'm gonna have to, of course, explain this as well, because this is a matter of importance here in these countries. For the Shafi'iyya and the Hanabila, and the Jumhur of Ahlul Ilm, everyone else, they see all animals to be pure besides the boar and the canine, their bodies, hair, and saliva. The Hanafiya say that their bodies are tahir, but their saliva is not. The Malikiya say the canine and the boar are both tahir, bodies and saliva. That makes sense. So when we understand the different opinions here, so the Jumhur, Shafi'i and Hanabil and other scholars as well, they see the canine and the boar to be najis, to be impure, both body and saliva, right? And the Hanafiya say that the body is tahir for the canine and the boar, but the saliva is not. The Malikiya see tahir both ways. I mean, they don't see najasa for the canine or the boar, bodies nor saliva, but they do believe that it's haram to eat them. Obviously, that is not changing. So it's haram to eat both the boar, and it's haram to be to the dog as well, as by qiyas. But for the Shafi'iyya, which is the ra'y of the Jumhur, then the boar and the canine are najis, both bodies and saliva. Now, I would consider what the Maliki and Hanafiya say regarding the skin or the bodies of dogs, specifically when you're living here, because it's sometimes very hard for you to, sometimes you're in an elevator, or you're walking down the street and a dog, you know, rubs up against you. Now, if you believe that it's najis, then you have to go and wash this up and wash your hands. It becomes very, very difficult for you to function. So you can take the Maliki and the Hanafiya, because they both see the body to be tahir. Now, when it comes to saliva, only the Maliki still see it to be tahir, and they do qiyas on the saliva of every other animal. And they don't, it's a long argument and debate between scholars to as why it's seen to be najis and why it's seen to be tahir. Like why is the body and saliva seen to be impure or pure? I'm not going to get into the detail of the dalil and how they see. They have their arguments and they have their reasonings and they have their understandings for why they see what they see. But this is what they see. This is how they see it. So you have the ability to take that rukhsa if you want to. Specifically, if you're living in a place where it's quite common for you to be, you know, rubbing up against dogs, or you have no choice to do it, then you should still be able to pray, maintaining your purity, understanding that some scholars, or half the madhab at least, see that the body of the canine and the boar to be tahir. Yes.
Is there agreement in the madhab that, yes, once an animal dies, if it wasn't slaughtered or if it wasn't taken,
yeah, that's a different thing.
Skin,
yeah. Yeah.
Do they all agree that the use of that animal is not like allowed if it wasn't done through that means of slaughtering or tanning?
Yeah. So the use of the meat, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. All of them agree.
Obviously, like in a lot of foods.
Yeah.
And stuff, we have,
yeah. So that. Yeah. So they all agree that it's not slaughtered. It's not slaughtered, I mean, one way or another. Then it's then we cannot use the meat, at least. So we can't use it for consumption. Yeah.
Like
for other things, maybe. Yeah. Najis? No, that animal is not najis. But if the meat of the pig is still in the mouth, then the saliva will be najis until he swallows it and it goes away. But no, they won't be najis by.
If a dog licks your hand.
So it licks your hand or your clothing. So you have two opinions here. You have the Jumhur that say that this is najis, so you have to clean it off before you pray. You have to wash your hand or wash your and or you can take what the Malikiya say, and that this is tahir and you can pray immediately. You don't have to do anything, right? I would wash it off at that point, because it's just the mura'at and limadhab al-jumhur, so you stick to what the jumhur say regarding that ruling. But there is a bit more, we'll talk about that in a second. Yeah, so you know, again, we'll always go back to what takes away wudu. If you forget, go back to the beginning. Only a couple of stuff take wudu away, right? Know them, and that's it. Nothing else takes wudu away. Anything else, you just need to remove. If the clothing and the najasa, remove that. If something, you don't need to repeat your wudu. If someone, yeah, any feces are in your hand, you don't need to make wudu again if you have wudu. Just wash it off and then go ahead and pray. You don't have to make wudu again. Know what invalidates your wudu and invalidates your, yeah, your, or makes you need a mandatory ghusl. So know what what they are, because there's only a couple of stuff. Know them, and then everything else, you just remove whatever najasa has, you know, has come your way. Now, وَالْمَيْتَةُ كُلُّهَا najisa, and everything that is dead, like Brother Emmanuel pointed out, not slaughtered in the dhabiha proper way, at least to a certain extent where, you know, there's some level of slaughtering, and there's some level of blood being released from the body before it dies. إِلَّا السَّمَكَ وَالْجَرَادَ وَالْآدَمِيَّ, except for three categories. Fish, so everything in the sea. Right, so we say fish, back then, this is, you know, a text written very long time ago by Abu Shuja' al-Asfahani rahimahullah, and back then they didn't really know the different types of living things that existed in the ocean, so they didn't know there were mammals and there were fish, and that wasn't clear to them. So for them, anything in the sea was a fish, like a whale was a fish back then. So anything that dies in the sea that is a marine mammal or a marine animal, so a marine mammal or a fish, then it's not najis. So if you find a fish floating on the top of it, you can pick it up and you can eat it. So it's not najis, it's not impure.
So we're talking about the unslaughtered animals, right?
Yeah, so we're talking about anything that dies that is not slaughtered in the proper dhabiha way. And of course, you know, you have to slaughter. You can't slaughter anything. You have to. You know, when we talk about slaughtering, we're talking about a couple of types of livestock. We're talking about cows and goats, sheep and camels. These are the stuff that you slaughter, and it becomes it's not najis after that. But everything else, it doesn't apply. So there's no halal way to slaughter a lion, because, you know, you're not going to have a lion for food. But if you need to, then that's a whole different story. If you have there's no other food, and mashallah, you're Tarzan and you can slaughter the lion, then go ahead and slaughter it before you eat it. But besides that, I can't think of another example where this would apply at all. So the first thing is samak, anything in the sea. Wal jarad, al-jarad is grasshoppers, and this is referring to insects. So, because he already talked about insects a second ago, that if an insect falls into a jug of water or a cup of water, it doesn't make it najis, even though it's dead. Like, does that make sense? Like, it just falls in dead, it doesn't make your cup najis, because it's an insect. Insects don't have blood, they have a circulative system in them, but it's not enough blood for it to be considered that has fluids in it. So any insect, any small insect is still, so up to a grasshopper it's acceptable. Spiders, cockroaches, of course not the mega cockroaches that we see in the Middle East, but the small ones that we have here, stuff like that are not najis if they're dead. And well, adami, and the human being, so the human being never is najis. When he dies, he doesn't turn into najis. He's still tahir when he dies. Okay, so those are the three categories of things that will die that will not become najis when they die. But other animals will be najis. So meaning you shouldn't, if you pick one up and you have, you need to wash your hands after that. Or if it's you have anything from it on you, then you need to wash it off from you. Okay. وَيُغْسَلُ الْإِنَاءُ مِنْ وُلُوغِ الْكَلْبِ وَالْخِنْزِيرِ سَبْعَ مَرَّاتٍ إِحْدَاهُنَّ بِالتُّرَابِ. And if an ina, if a container has a boar or a canine drink from it or eat from it, then it needs to be, if you are to use it, of course, not for them to use it, but for you to use it again, right? Then you need to wash it seven times. One of them needs to be with turab, with sand. I mean, you have to sand it up one of those times. So you wash it seven each time with water, dump it out, water again, dump it out, water again. Then one of the times has to be with turab. Now, not everyone agrees to this. Now, obviously the Malikiyah don't see this at all, because they don't see the saliva of the dog or the boar to be najis to begin with, so that doesn't apply to them at all. And the Hanafiyah don't accept that specifically. I mean, they see the saliva to be najis, but you don't need to do it seven times. It's just one time. Right? And again, I'm not going to get into the why part of this, because that this will turn our study into a tertiary text study. Maybe it'll take forever us to finish if I'm going to go through all the edifs. Inshallah, the next step of this series of halaqat, when we're done like all the small texts of the madahib, we will study inshallah something that has comparative fiqh as a part of it. Yes, what can I do for you?
My dad is not coming from home. I need somebody to call him.
Okay, go to Ammu Ali there, he'll help you, help you to have a make a phone call. Inshallah.
Like, you know, when a dog is a prey animal, it catches,
yeah,
and that animal is still halal, the same saliva,
yeah,
caught by the dog,
yeah.
How come?
So the Shafi'iyya in the see a difference between al-kalb al-mudarrab wal-kalb ghayr al-mudarrab. So they see a difference between a dog that is used for hunting, a hunting dog, and a non-hunting dog. And the Hanabila don't, or some of them do. Actually, this guy is kind of middle right in the madhab. We're not that'll come up sometime in the text later on to talk about. But they do differentiate between a stray dog and a hunting dog that you have prepared and trained to actually do the job. And that's why the Maliki and the Hanafiya are much more loose when it comes to issues of dog saliva, because they say, well, the Quran says, فَكُلُوا مِمَّا أَمْسَكْنَا عَلَيْكُمْ. This is what the Quran says, and then you're giving me a hadith that Abu Huraira himself didn't even follow, and he was observed not following a number of times. And there's other hadith that also go, you know, the hadith that talks about it, that if a dog drinks from Nina, then he should wash it seven times. But there are other hadith that the dogs would walk into the masjid in and out and drink and did nothing. So there, it's a matter. This is where fiqh is. The ulama would take all this evidence and then they would discuss it and they would debate it and they would, you know, come with their own understanding. So when I give you the understandings, I'm giving you the understandings of scholars who looked into the evidence quite deeply. Right now, I'm not trying to look into the evidence with you. I'm just trying to give you different opinions so that you can choose what you knowing that what all the opinions that I'm giving to you are valid. You can choose one of them, you're fine. If you want to say, no, I don't feel comfortable, I want to stick to the more strict opinion on this, then you're allowed to do that. And if you want to take the lenient opinion on dogs and boars, then you can do that. You can do that as well. I believe it comes to, you know, to circumstances more. Meaning, it's more based on your circumstances. If you're someone who's working daily with dogs and boars, then you need to take what the Maliki say on this issue, because there is a level of leniency in the issue. And if you're someone who barely ever sees a dog or a boar in his life, then, you know, you can stick to what the Hanabi say. So it's basically kind of it's more on what your circumstances are. Yeah.
Well, your canine example.
Say again, can you what?
Like, example, if you bought a canine for like a guard dog.
Yeah.
And then after, like, example, for your house or whatever.
Sure.
And then, so that would be, so it wouldn't be najas.
So, for the Shafi'iyya, it wouldn't be. And for some of the Hanabila, it wouldn't be. For the Hanafi and Malikiyya, it's not najas at all. If it's a trained canine. My understanding of all this, if you want to put aside like all the different opinions, my understanding of it, wallahu a'lam, what I see is that the Prophet ﷺ, when he was talking about the najasa of a dog, he was referring to stray dogs. And I come from a rural part of the world where there are a lot of stray dogs. Dogs that just run in the mountains, and they usually have rabies. They have a lot of different diseases. They're very, very dirty. Like they're filthy animals. So talking about the Prophet ﷺ probably was talking about that type of dogs, and he was not referring to dogs who were pets or who were guard dogs or hunting dogs. Or he wasn't talking about that, because you do have the ability. A dog can be trained to refrain from certain activities and from eating certain things and from doing certain things. We will keep him away from impurities. So Allahu A'lam, this is where the difference of opinion exists. But the ulama have these opinions that I shared with you, right? So you can feel free to choose or to follow whatever one you feel.
So does this procedure go for other objects as well, or is it just if they drink from a bowl of water?
From any container. So if they lick any container, right, then that's what you need to do, right? So you need to wash it seven times. This is what the Shafi'i is saying, and this is what the Hanabila also accept, that you wash it seven times. One of them has to be with sand. The Hanafi and Maliki don't see that at all. The Hanafi say you have to wash it once, because they still see the saliva to be najis, and the Maliki say it's not najis at all, so you don't have to do anything. Like the Maliki, for them, the dog is just like a cat. They don't see a difference. And they believe that the hadith is ta'abudi.
Yes. Common thing in the villages, if a dog falls in the bells.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to remove all the water?
No. So of course that's a different issue. This is they have a different opinion on what you do if a dog was to fall into a well or any dead animal, because once it's dead, because it's going to be dead down after. So when it's dead, they're all the same. It could be a dead cat, a dead dog, a dead horse. Anything. If it's dead, then it's najis and it's in the well. So what are you supposed to do? So the scholars have different opinions. The Hanafiya, they have an interesting comment on this. They say you would take out a certain amount of water. So you would get rid of, I think it's 200 liters for them, which is qullatain. They get rid of that amount of water, and then and after that you can start using it normally. For the jumhur, you can just use it the same. There are some opinions that tell you to close down the well, and that of course that doesn't work in places where this is the only source of water that people have, and we're not closing this, dude. We're going to use this, because if we don't, we're going to starve, or we're going to, you know, die from thirst. So, but there's different ways of looking at it. Yeah.
And there actually was a hadith where there was a well where there actually was known najasa in the well, where someone permitted them to continue to use it. So that gives more strength. The point for the tain, if there's at least maybe 200 something liters, then just go ahead.
Yep. Jazakallah. Okay, so that's yes, okay.
So is it possible to have a dog?
So basically what you take from what I said is, I didn't talk about whether it's okay to own one or not. We'll come to that inshallah later on in the text. What I did talk about is whether it's najis or not najis. Right? So I told you what the Jumhur say. They see the Shafi'i and Hanabila say that the body and saliva are najis. The Hanafiya say the body, but not the saliva, but not the body is najis. And the Maliki say nothing about it is najis. So when you say, can I own a dog, right? Then you're going to go by one of two things. Either you're accepting the Malikiya's understanding of what canines are, or you are accepting what the Shafi'iyya, Hanafiya, and half of the Hanabila accept to be trained dogs, right? Because they have an understanding of trained dogs. But still, it's more of a cultural problem with dogs than it is a religious one. Certain things are more cultural than they are religious. I personally do not want a dog in my house, ever. For no reason, there's nothing you can tell me that will make me want to have a dog in my house. I don't care if, you know, you've been pampering this dog since the day it was born and you feed it with your, I don't care. Don't bring it close to me, I don't want to see it, don't want it touching me. I just don't like dogs. It's just a cultural thing. I grew up in a place where dogs were not something I was comfortable with, and I still am not comfortable with. Like, I won't get in an elevator when there's a dog. It's not racism against dogs. I just don't like being around dogs. I have no problem. I love the animals. I just don't want them around me. It's a cultural thing. Your parents will never be okay with dogs. Do not try to bring a dog into your parents' house. And if you do, don't come crying to me, because I won't defend you. I'm not going to tell you, well, the Maliki is, and I'm not going to do it. I don't care. It's your problem. Don't, because there's a difference between understanding the fiqh of stuff and then what is practical for cultural sensitivities. I want you to think about, if you're young, memorize these two words and keep them in your mind. Cultural sensitivities. Memorize those two words. These are things that are important. They matter to your parents. They matter. Cultural sensitivities. I don't see, for example, any problems with haircuts. My fiqhi understanding of haircuts, I don't care. If you walk into here with a rainbow mohawk on your head, it doesn't matter to me. Religiously, I don't see a problem with it. But your dad will literally have a heart attack if he sees you, shaving the side of your head. It's cultural. It's just how it is. You can't help it. It happens to me as well. Like, if I see someone with a certain haircut, I cringe. My stomach kind of, it hurts. I don't know why. I'm not used to it. It's culturally, I'm not accustomed to it. Some things are very cultural and some things are religious. Sometimes we make the mistake of trying to get the deen or the religion to side by our cultural desires. And I don't think that's fair. Like, when there's more than one opinion, we should be open to the opinions. We can't walk around saying that, no, dogs are all, no, that's not true. There is a very strong, there's an opinion that is mu'tabar, that is respected within the world of jurisprudence, that doesn't see them to be, you can agree with to be najis, you can agree with their opinion, or you can disagree, you have the right to do both, but it's still there. Their opinion still exists, and it has some merits, and it has, it deserves to be heard. Right, and then if you find it makes sense to you, and then you can go ahead with that. And wallahu alam. But when it comes to owning dogs, that's a whole different ball game. Okay, we go on, inshallah. ويغسل من سائر النجاسات مرة تأتي عليه والثلاثة أفضل. And then from every other type of najasa, so bowl, urine, bowl, feces, blood, pus, any other type of urine, then you wash. مرةً تأتي علي, just one time. And there's a hadith that Ibn Umar, it's narrated by Abu Dawood, it's a hadith that is Hassan, where he says, كانت الصلاة 50, there were 50 صلاة, والغسل من الجنابة 7 مرار, and you would do غسل from جنابة 7 times, وغسل البول 7 مرار, and you would wash from urine also 7 times. فلم يزل رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم يسأل التخفيفة حتى صارت الصلاة 5, and the Prophet ﷺ kept on asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make it easier until prayer became 5, والغسل من الجنابة الغسل من الجنابة مرة, and the غسل became 1 time, وغسل البولي وغسل البولي ثوبي بول الثوبي أو بول الثوبي مرة, and then to wash urine from your garment also became 1. It's a hadith that is Hassan, some people say it's ضعيف, but anyways, that's what they use for this. So everything else you just do one with ثلاثة أفضل, and they say 3 is better, and they have no evidence for that. It's just a matter that everything the Prophet ﷺ did in his life, if he could, he did it 3 times, so maybe this is something you should do 3 times, but they don't have evidence for it. Yeah,
or maybe they would just assume because when he woke up in the morning he would wash his hands.
Sure, there you go, 3 times. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and everything in when it comes to cleaning najasat is the debate between whether it is ta'abudi or it's hukum. Is it a ruling, or is it a general ruling, or is it just a ruling of ta'abud, meaning it's an act of worship within it? So, and that's where they kind of differ. I'm not going to get into that right now because it's a more of a philosophical point than it is.
Doesn't mean that there is some clothing that has this urine, and I don't have to wash it in the washing machine.
Yeah, you can do it once, right? You just wash it once, but wash it 3 times in your washing machine. Because please have mercy on everyone, ya Sheikh, and wash it 3 times in your washing machine. But it's ثلاثة أفضل, but 3 is better. Okay. وإذا تخللت الخمرة بنفسها طهرت. Another type of najasa is alcohol. right? Alcohol that is there for consumption, not the stuff that they use in the hospitals for cleaning wounds and sanitizing wounds, right? We're talking about actual consumable alcohol. So that alcohol is najis. So if someone pours alcohol, alcohol comes on you, then you need to wash that off. And you have to take it out before you pray because it's najis.
Alcohol or the wine?
Kullu zay ba'du. Beer, wine.
Even the perfume, it has a
perfume. So that's not consumable alcohol. You can't drink it. Yani, can you open a perfume? You die. Yani. Yeah, no. So there's.
Even alcohol.
Yeah. So.
Like the rubbing alcohol. I mean, is isopropyl? Is it considered?
Yeah. So that's the thing. The thing is that alcoholic compounds are very different. What Islam talks about as haram for consumption and najis in its nature is the consumable type. Right, it's not the stuff that is used in medicine, and it's not the perfumes and not anything else. It's just the stuff that is consumable, that is intoxicating. Even meaning to even be more specific, it has to be intoxicating as well, because there are other compounds or things that have certain levels or certain amounts of alcoholic compounds in it, but it's not intoxicating. It's just a part of what it is. Regardless, that's a bit more that's a bit deeper than what I think we should go into right now. Text is saying very simply, إِذَا تَخَلَّلَتْ if it, what is the word, what is the translation of تَخَلَّلَتْ in the English translation? What are they using? If it's what? Yeah, so what is تَخَلَّلَتْ? What is the translation there? I'm just interested to know what the... Yeah, exactly, because I'm going to say pickled, but it's not going to be pickled. It
turns into, I think.
Yeah, so alcohol can lose its characteristics, and it can go from being alcohol to being vinegar. So it can turn into vinegar to be, I think, vinegarized. I don't know. Maybe that's a word. Maybe it's not. But it can be turned into vinegar. So if alcohol is, if you add water to it, or if water is taken, or if you left it in the sun, there's different things that can happen to it that it can turn into vinegar. So if that happens to it on its own, meaning it's just left for a while and then it turns into vinegar, then it's tahir now. Yes.
I think maybe the best word would be denatured, because that's when you break away the original.
There you go, denatured. But yeah, I know that there's a word for it. I should know it because I studied chemistry. I can't remember the word. I know it in Arabic. I don't know it in English. But so it changes. It goes from being alcohol to being vinegar. And when it does that on its own, then it is tahir, meaning the vinegar itself is back to being. It's no longer najis anymore. وَإِنْ خُلِّلَتْ بِطَرْحِ شَيْءٍ فِيهَا لَمْ تَطْهُرْ. And this is the again, this is the opinion of the Shafi'iyya. So let's say that it turns into vinegar. Not on its own, but by putting something in it. So you put something in it and then it turns into vinegar. Then it's going to still be najis. Why? Because the thing that you threw into it, when it entered, it touched something najis, so it became najis. Right? So yes, it turned into vinegar, but it's still najis, that thing. Right? So that thing that you put into it is still najis. So now you have a small container of vinegar that has something najis in it, which means this whole thing is still najis. So that's how the Shafi'i look at it. Other scholars have very different opinions on this issue. Actually, every madhab is kind of divided right in half. Even the Shafi'i have many opinions within them that say that it's not najis anymore. Yes?
So if you add a catalyst, would they allow it if it's pure? Because some of the madhab say that you can't add a catalyst whatsoever, regardless if it's pure, if it's impure. So
they don't. The Shafi'i, most of them, not all of them.
Just has to happen naturally.
Yeah, most of them, but some of them, there are other opinions within the Shafi'i madhab that see that if something is capable of purifying khamr, then it cannot be turned into, it cannot be made impure. Like soap, right? Soap is not najis because you touched it with your, grubby hands or whatever it is you were washing off, right? So it didn't, because it's capable of purifying you, right? So the same thing goes for whatever it is you put into the alcohol and turned it into vinegar. So some of them accept that, and I think that's more, makes more sense, yeah.
Maybe a bit unrelated, but what if, like, you're selling alcohol and you make money from it? Is that money?
Haram, definitely, yeah.
But if you, have, somewhat of a store.
Yeah, so don't have alcohol or cigarettes or lotto tickets or shisha or masal or any of that stuff. Just don't sell stuff that have shubha in it, right? If or pork. As a Muslim, you shouldn't be dealing with these things directly. Now, since you asked the question, so if you're working at a place that sells sometimes pork or meat, then you can. If you're a delivery person, then you're fine. You can deliver it. It's not a problem. You can't actually cook it.
as a Muslim, you shouldn't be cooking meat, pork. When it comes to alcohol, no, you can't cook it. You can't use it in your cooking. You cannot consume it. You cannot carry it. You can't deliver it. You can't handle it at all. Meaning, so if you're going to get a job at Superstore or at Lowe's or at you're getting a job there, then you need to be very clear with the person you're talking to that I don't handle alcohol. And if they're not okay with that, then find a different place to work. Right? Just find a different place that doesn't make you work with alcohol. Because you have a right, actually, from a religious point of view here in this country, to ask for that. That I don't, religiously, I cannot touch alcohol at all. I don't carry it. I don't put it in a bag. I don't do anything. I don't touch it at all. So, you know, and stand up for your rights. If you're going to work, ask, you know, you have the right not to have to deal with that garbage. You know? So ask for that.
So you can or can't cook pork?
So pork, you can't cook it. No, you shouldn't be cooking it. If you deliver it like a pizza with pepperoni, that's fine. Because it's lahm, it's meat. So it's halal bi asli, haram bi far'ihi. So it's haram with it's an extension of meat that's haram. But alcohol is haram with its origin. It's haram, all of it, everything about it. So you shouldn't be dealing with it in any form. And that's, I know that's a bit hard here, but actually the Canadian laws allow for it easily, meaning you have the right to ask when you go to employed not to work with certain substances, and especially for religious reasons. And inshallah, if you don't get a job at, you know, Superstore, you'll get a job elsewhere, inshallah, and you'll be able to work.
Allergy for alcohol.
Allergy? There's no allergies of alcohol. I wish there were. Actually, that would be a good allergy to to spread amongst the world, Danny, and fix a lot of problems. If you're allergic to alcohol, that would be awesome. Anyways, so that's the now Faslun, a new chapter within the Taharat. وَيَخْرُجُ مِنَ الْفَرْجِ ثَلَاثَةُ دِمَاءٍ. And there are three types of blood that come from الفرج, from basically the reproductive system. So we're not talking about leaving the, this is for women specifically. So what we're going to study right now is what happens to ladies during that time of the month, and what happens to them after birth. Right, and then something else that happens if there's a medical condition. So three types of blood will leave a lady from her reproductive system. دم الحيض والنفاس والاستحاضة. So الحيض, which is the menstrual period blood, and النفاس is the after giving birth, the blood that comes after giving birth, and الاستحاضة is basically blood that comes in between periods. So in between her periods, so this is not the time of her period, and blood comes out. Right. So these three types of blood are important for the lady to know how she's going to do her prayers, and if she can fast or if she cannot fast and whatnot. So فالحيض هو الدم الخارج من فرج المرأة على سبيل الصحة من غير سبب الولادة. So menstrual blood is the blood that comes out of her in her natural healthy status without having given birth to anything. ولونه أسود محتدم لذاع, and it has a certain color. It's a dark black color. And women know when it's a menstrual period blood, so they know what it looks like and they know what the texture of it is. والنفاس هو الدم الخارج عقب الولادة, and after birth there's blood that comes out for a certain period of time as well. والاستحاضة هو الدم الخارج في غير أيام الحيض والنفاس, and then استحاضة is blood that leaves a lady that is not her menstrual period and it's not after birth, so it's just in between periods that sometimes she will have some amounts of blood leave her. Now وأقل الحيض يوم وليلة, and the smallest amount or the shortest amount of حيض of a menstrual period is a day and a night. وأكثره خمسة عشر يوما, and the longest or the will be 15 days. غالبه ست أو سبع, most commonly six or seven. Now a lot of what we're going to read in the next page are issues that medicine today have nailed down. Medicine has nailed down to the to the detail. So medicine now knows exactly what is menstrual period blood and what is not. So everything that you're reading is not shara. It is it comes from an-nazar or from istiqra. So observations and basic knowledge or common knowledge that existed at the time when he was writing this text. So there, from their observation, the least a menstrual period can be is a day, and the longest can be 15 days. Now today there's a bit different numbers. So if it's 15 days, you should go see a doctor. Like there's probably something there that's problematic within the lady's period. If it's less than one day, then she also should go see a physician. It should be between 3 days to around 9 days. Before anything less or more, she go see a physician. So this is not set. These aren't set numbers. And yes, and most of the madhab have the same numbers, by the way. Like most of the madhab have the same numbers, because that was, where did they get these numbers from? Did the shuyukh who wrote these texts? They got it from medicine, from medical doctors at the time. Like they asked, okay, what is the least amount of time that a hayd, a menstrual period, can go, and they would tell them, and they would write it down. So today we have these things understood in much more detail. So we use, you refer to medicine here. A lot of these things you're going to refer to medicine. If medicine tells you this is menstrual period, then you don't pray. The lady doesn't pray, doesn't fast. And if she tells them it's not menstrual period, then she goes a hayd and she prays and she fasts. So a lot of this is going to be answered by medicine. And this is an example where worldly knowledges become a part of fiqh, become a part of jurisprudence, Islamic jurisprudence, because you need medicine to tell you what's going on. وَأَقَلُّ النِّفَاسِ لَحْظَةً, and the shortest period of afterbirth blood is a moment, just like one stream of blood. وَأَكْثَرُهُ سِتُّونَ يَوْمًا, and the longest is 60 days. وَغَالِبُهُ أَرْبَعُونَ يَوْمًا, and most commonly is 40 days. So it is most commonly 40 days, but if it goes to 60, then she should be seeing a physician. This probably means that she has some inflammation or some infection inside, and this could be very, very, very problematic for her. وَقَلُّ الطُّهْرِ بَيْنَ الْحَيْضَتَيْنِ 15 يَوْمًا وَلَا حَدَّ لِأَكْثَرِهِ, and the shortest amount of time between two periods, two menstrual periods, is 15 days, and it can go as long as you want. Because yes, sometimes a lady will not have a menstrual period for years. For years she can go without a menstrual period, right? When she hits a certain age, there's no more periods at all. And sometimes she's pregnant, and that's like 9 months where there's no periods at all. So she can go for tuhr for a very long time. Like she could maintain religious purity for a very, very long time for salah. But the least amount of time is 15 days. So that's the least amount of time between menstrual periods, yes.
Does she have to make up her prayers?
No, never, no. Doesn't make up anything, yeah. She makes up her fasting.
وأقل زمن تحيض فيه المرأة 9 سنين,
and the youngest age for a lady to reach menstruation is 9 years. Again, this is all based on what they, يعني, this is based on their observations of the time. Again, medicine answers these questions. Like if you want to know if 9 is not that weird a number, even here, like it's not that uncommon. But 9 years old, if a young girl or a young boy hit menstruation, then you should, or you know, they hit puberty, then you should take them to see a physician, because there may be some endocrine problem. They could have something that needs to be taken care of. So the idea here is that a lot of these things are based on observations, and medicine today answers most of these questions. Biology today even does the same. وَقَلُّ الْحَمْلِ 6 أَشْهُرْ, and the shortest amount of time for pregnancy is 6 months, right? And that is pretty accurate even today. Even today, the shortest amount. But today it's different. You get to see everything, and you know there's someone following up, and you know what's going on. But 6 months is actually, a lady could give a birth to a baby that has the ability to live. It's not very common, but it happens. Every full moon. وَأَكْثَرُهُ 4 سِنِينَ, and the longest period for pregnancy is 4 years. Now, I don't know where they got that number from. I really am interested to see the lady who was pregnant for 4 years and what she gave birth to, like an elephant or I'm not sure what they gave birth to at the time. But again, this is all, you know, apparently some lady back then was pregnant for 4 years, or I have no idea how that works. But again, medicine fixes a lot of these things. These are just their limited understanding at the time of biology and of medicine. All right. وَغَالِبُهُ 9 أَشْهُرْ, and the most common number is nine months. And the Quran actually gives us the number 6 months for the shortest amount of time of a normal pregnancy. Because so if let's say the lady gives birth after 5.5 months. Now the fetus may live, but it's going to need an incubator for a very, very long time, and it's going to be very, very ill for a long time as well. If she gives him birth at 6 months, there is a possibility that this fetus can live on its own. It's a very, it's very slim chances, but the chances exist, like it may live. And the Quran it came from the Quran. How? So وَحَمْلُهُ وَفِصَالُهُ, right? 30 شَهْرًا, and the pregnancy and the time that you're going to spend breastfeeding this child is 30 months. Right? وَفِصَالُهُ فِي عَامَيْنِ, another ayah says, and the breastfeeding period are 2 years. 2 years, how many months are 2 years? 24. So take away 30 months from 24, 24 from 30, 6 months. So that's the shortest period of time that a lady can be. And Imam Ali radiallahu anhu, he caught that in a very known story. All right. وَيَحْرُمُ بِالْحَيْضِ وَالنِّفَاسِ 8 أَشْيَاءَ, and what becomes haram to do when you have, when you're through, when a lady is going through nifas and hayd, going through menstrual period or afterbirth bleeding, as-salatu, so she cannot pray, was-sawmu, and she cannot fast, wa-qira'atu al-Qur'ani, and she cannot read Qur'an, but hold on to that for a second, wa-mas'u al-mushafi wa-hamluhu, and touching the mushaf or carrying it, wa-dukhulu al-masjidi, and then entering the masjid, wa-tawafu, and then doing tawaf around the Kaaba, wal-wat'u, and intercourse with her husband. وَالْإِسْتِمْتَاعُ بِمَا بَيْنَ السُّرَّةِ وَالرُّكْبَةِ, and then sexual pleasure between the navel and the knee. All right. So let's talk about what is agreed upon and what is not agreed upon, so that this is, you know, this is clear. So yes, she cannot. It's agreed upon that she cannot pray and she cannot fast. Now it is not agreed upon that she cannot read Quran. Now there's actually a lot of different opinions regarding that specific topic, and I believe the closer to the being correct in this issue from a jurisprudent point of view is that she's allowed to read Quran. But the Shafi'iyya do stick to that opinion that she cannot recite the Quran during her menstrual period. But that's not the consensus among scholars.
So what's that based on? So was there like a
There was a hadith narrated by Ibn Majah where that indicates that لا يقرأ الجنوب والحائض القرآن, so شيء من القرآن, that they shouldn't be reading Quran, the junub and the hail, so someone who has janaba and someone who has hail, and that of course there's other hadith that contradict that and or stronger than it, and this hadith was understood in its own context as well. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, if someone that if they do, for example, pray and they're during that period, does their prayer not count, or does their prayer not count?
So the prayer doesn't count, definitely, and you don't have to repeat your prayer she doesn't have to repeat her prayer during that time anyway. So she doesn't really do anything. As far as reciting Quran, like I said, there's more than one opinion here anyway. So the Shafi'i are very strong on the fact that she can't read, but others don't. And almost within the madhab, there's a division in each madhab regarding this specific ruling. Now, وَمَسُّ الْمُصْحَفِ وَحَمْلُهُ, touching the mushaf and carrying it. Now touching the mushaf and carrying it, we'll talk about it here and then we'll talk about it again in a second when we talk about the junub, because the junub, meaning someone who has janaba, who has religious impurity, high or major religious impurity, meaning after, if you guys remember, after intercourse, or after ejaculating, or after death, one of those three things which causes you to have major religious impurity, you'll find it almost the same stuff. So, مَسْتُ الْمُصْحَفِ وَحَمْلُ, touching the mushaf and carrying it. And this is a very, now all the madhahib, to my knowledge, don't see it okay to carry the mushaf and touch the Quran when a lady has hayd, when she's in her menstrual period, or when a man has janaba after. However, the evidence that they use for that has been debated heavily within the last 30 or 40 years, and they've talked about it a lot. Because the only evidence that they have for that is إِنَّهُ لَقُرْآنٌ كَرِيمٌ in Surah Al-Baqi'ah, فِي كِتَابٍ مَكْنُونٌ لَا يَمَسُّهُ إِلَّا الْمُطَهَّرُونَ, only touches it those who are purified. And it was argued many times that the purified here, is it talking about the physical purity, or is it talking about spiritual purity? So what is it talking about? And is it talking about human beings, or is this talking about malaika altogether? So it was heavily debated among scholars, and there are a lot of opinions today that support her reading the Quran and carrying the mushaf during her period. And I tend to kind of side with those opinions a bit more than what the traditional madhahib have given as fatawa regarding this specific issue, whether for the lady during her menstrual period or whether for the man during his janaba.
There's a scholar named Jamal Zarabozo, and he wrote maybe 30-40 pages.
Sure.
Treaties on this. Mm-hmm. And he basically said that all the hadith that talk about like a person not being able to touch the Quran or recite the Quran, there's weakness in all of it.
Yeah.
And we also know the Prophet, he used to remember Allah in all states, and therefore if there's no clear evidence to say absolute prohibition, then he would view that we should.
Yeah. And I tend to side with that a bit more as well. So five, wadukhul al-masjid. Now entering the masjid. So entering the masjid is a bit of a different point here. So there is a narration from Imam Ahmad and Dawood al-Zahiri and Ibn Hazm and a number of other scholars like Sufyan al-Thawri and a bunch of other scholars don't see any problem for her entering the masjid and listening to a dars. The prominent position within the madhahib, even for the Hanabila, for the Shafi'i as well, is that she shouldn't enter the masjid. Right, and that goes for the junub. So you're going to find that the junub and the hayd have the same, almost the same rulings. Now, I tend also to side by the other opinion of her entering the masjid, because the reasoning behind her not entering the masjid back then was the fact that there was fear of blood, because things back then were much more, you know, they didn't have the a lot of the luxuries that we have today. So there was always the possibility that blood would come onto the masjid and then make najasa on the ground. So today that's not even like, I don't think that happens like very often. I think it happens at all. So and there are pieces of evidence that contradict the concept of her not being able to enter the masjid. So there is a half of the Hanabila accept this, and a lot of the other scholars that are not part of the madhab also accepted as well, but the prominent position within the four madhab is that she doesn't enter the masjid during her menstrual period. So it's a riwayah an Ahmad. So it's a narration from Imam Ahmad and Ibn Hazm, rahmatullah alayhi, and Dawood al-Zahiri and Thawri, wallahu alam. Those are the ones who side with this, and there's others as well who do the same.
So they approve, and everyone else,
yeah,
the jumhur
doesn't approve it. All right. What tawaf? Of course, tawaf is pretty much agreed upon, because it's like, because tawaf is like prayer. Prayer is equivalent to tawaf. So if you're not allowed to pray, and that is something that is agreed upon, then you're not allowed to do tawaf. And what, which is intercourse, and that is clear during the menstrual period of a woman, intercourse is not acceptable at all. It's haram, and there's ithm. There's punishment for both the man, like in the akhirah, for both men and women for doing it.
If this happened during the Hajj, what should?
Oh, this is okay. Let's leave that until we study Hajj, because when you're not allowed to فَلَا رَفَثَ وَلَا فُسُوقَ فَلَا رَفَثَ فِي الْحَجِّ, and doing that, you know, it becomes a we have to talk about any كَفَّارَاتَهَا. Inshallah, we'll talk about that when we come to Hajj بإذن الله تعالى. Now the last point, والاستمتاع ما بين السرة والركبة, which is sexual pleasure between the navel and the knees. So let's say that she's in her menstrual period, and she's married, and she fools around with her husband, right? So is it okay for them to fool around within that area, or is it not okay for them to fool around? Now, the Shafi'iyya don't accept that, but the others do. So it's pretty much, it's almost just the Shafi'iyya. I believe, I'm thinking that the Hanabila also don't accept that, but I'm not sure. But I know that the Hanafi and the Maliki are okay with this, meaning they're okay with this istimta' ma bayna as-surrati wa rukba biha'il. Biha'il means that there's clothing, so on top of clothing. So it's not, there's no no skin on skin, it's just on top of clothing. Of course, those of you who are not married shouldn't be listening to any of this, and should act like they didn't hear it until they are married, and then you can ask me again, inshallah, when you are. But for those who are married, then this is something that matters. For the Shafi'iyya, they have a very strict opinion on it, that it's haram for this. Now, my understanding of the madhab, and some people will differ with me, is that this, what the Imam is saying here, pleasure between these two points, he's talking if it's skin on skin. He's not talking with clothing. So with clothing, if that's the case, then with clothing, all the madhahib are okay with that type of sexual pleasure that can happen. So on top of clothing, where there's no intercourse happening. Yeah. So if this is, because here there's a difference within this text itself. What did he mean, Abu Shuja? Did he mean with clothing, without clothing? So if he meant without clothing, right, then with clothing everyone is okay.
All four are,
right? So it's a matter of just understanding what did he mean, rahimahullah, when he when he said that. I'm going to wait for the, is it adhan now? Are we going to wait for the adhan, or? No, just wait for the adhan. You want to stop? We'll wait for the adhan, inshallah. We'll finish, inshallah, what's left. وَيَحْرُمُ عَلَى الْجُنُوبِ خَمْسَةُ أَشْيَاءَ. And there are five things that are haram for someone who has janabah. So someone, a man or a woman, who have just had sexual intercourse or ejaculated, and then there are five things that are haram here. Number one is salah. Obviously, you're not allowed to pray. You need to go and have ghusl before you can pray. وَقِرَاءَةُ الْقُرْآنِ وَمَسُّ الْمُصْحَفِ وَحَمْلُهُ. So the same two things that we talked about a second ago for ladies. So it's not haram for him, for you to have siyam. And this is something that I find people to mix up a lot, and I always enjoy the questions, because there's nothing to do. So let's say that you are married, and you sleep and you have a wet dream, yeah, and you forgive me, and you wake up before sahur, and you have janabah. Now what do you do? No, you just have your suhoor and that's it. Like, yeah, you start your day and then you have a shower to pray. So you don't have to have tahara to fast. Like, now what happened? The problem is if during fasting you intentionally, yani, ejaculate or have intercourse, like intentionally. If you, let's say you, it's 3 o'clock during the day, and there's it's one of those summer, yani, Ramadans, and the Maghrib is 10 o'clock and it's 3 o'clock and you can't even see it in front of you because you're so hungry. So you decide to take a nap, you sleep, and then you wake up and you had a wet dream. So what? Nothing. Just have a shower so you can pray. Your siyam is fine. So none of this does. So if you sleep and you wake up, let's say you sleep at night, you don't wake up for suhoor, and that's how Allah, may Allah forgive you, you didn't wake up for fajr at all. You woke up at 10 o'clock and you had a wet dream. So what? No, your siyam is fine. There's no problem with your siyam. So it's not haram for a junub to have to fast. It will break your fast if you intentionally do it, during your fasting. That will invalidate your fasting. Okay, just to make sure that's clear to everyone, inshallah. Now, the same thing we talked about, the lady who is menstruating, when it comes to carrying, reading the Quran and touching the Quran, applies to the person who has janaba. Meaning, not everyone agrees to this. The Shafi'iyya have a very strict opinion on it, meaning a junub shouldn't read the Quran. But the opinions that exist today, even within the Shafi'i madhab, see it to be permissible. Even in the Shafi'i madhab, they still see it to be permissible to read the Quran. Touching the Quran, most scholars don't accept it. Like, I tell you that it's been debated lately, so there are scholars who have seen it to be acceptable, but still most scholars don't accept touching the Quran if you don't have, most of them don't accept you touching the Quran if you don't have wudu. Like, most scholars don't accept that as either, but I find that to be a bit too strict, wallahu a'lam, because the evidence that they use is not too strong and is very figurative and is not decisive. I mean, it's more based on interpretation than it is on clarity of what is meant, wallahu a'lam, because the reason being that the Quran in its form, meaning the book, didn't exist during the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it's almost impossible for us to draw perfect analogies, because the Quran, in the way it looks right now, like in a book with a thing, wasn't what it was back then. The Quran was known, the sequence of it and the surahs were all there, written on different pieces of different boards here and there, but the Quran wasn't gathered into the form that we have right now, meaning in one book, until after he died sallallahu alaihi wasallam, by a number of years. Yes.
So you can read the Quran
So you can recite the Quran without wudu, that's fine. They're just talking about touching the mushaf, so many scholars, most scholars don't accept that. So the Shafi'iyya don't accept you reading the Quran while you have janaba. So that's why for the Shafi'iyya, you should have a shower immediately after this happens, the moment you're done, so that you can go back to reading the Quran. But not all scholars agree to that, and the madhab have different opinions. Actually, the majority of scholars in the madhab, when it comes to reading Quran with janaba, they're fine with that. It's touching the Quran that they don't accept, and they differ on, can you touch the Quran with a cloth or with something? I don't even like going down that road. It's too much of a, it's too complicated of an issue.
What about the point then about
so in the Quran, how it's seen, and if it, if, sorry, say it again.
What was the point of that ayah that law was if it wasn't in a book form?
The opinion of Ibn Abbas, I think, is that this is actually Lawh al-Mahfuz.
Yeah, exactly.
The Quran, the tablet that's in the sama, in the heavens. Yeah. It's actually not talking about the earthly Quran.
Exactly. So fi kitabin maknoon. In a preserved, protected capsule or book capsule. Now that didn't exist even during the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He never did like during his time alayhi salatu wasalam. So this is, like he said, wallahu a'lam, referring to something that exists in the realm that we don't have access to, right? La yamassuhu lil mutahharun is not observed by, touched by, because mess also has literal meanings and figurative meanings as well. So it can also mean that they don't have access to it and they're not allowed to, to understand it or comprehend it or practice, except those who are purified from the inside, meaning have spiritual purity. Wallahu a'lam. So there's different. When you look at the tafsir of the ayat, there's more than one way to understand it to begin with. But the Shafi'i, this is what they see. They don't see it's permissible to touch it or to read it during janaba, we have janaba, or during menstruation. And that's the opinion of the Shafi'i. And you can take the other opinions if you want to, but that's what they say. All right. What tawaf? Of course, tawaf, like I said, if you can't pray, then you can't do tawaf, because tawaf and prayer are equivalent. Wal lubthu fil masjidi, and then hanging around in the masjid. And that the same thing for the ladies during menstruation applies to men with janaba and women in janaba. If you have janaba, not all of them agree to that. Actually, the majority of scholars say it's okay for you to have janaba and to be in the masjid, right? They say it's adab that you go and you get rid of your janaba because you want to be pure when you're, because you're in the masjid, what are you doing? You're either praying or, what are you doing in the masjid? There's one of those two things. So you shouldn't have janaba for those stuff. But, you should be okay staying. But the Shafi'i say that you shouldn't, lubth meaning spending time. Walking through is fine, but spending time, they don't see that to be permissible. If you have janabah, you should go do ghusl and then come back. وَيَحْرُمُ عَلَى الْمُحْدِثِ ثَلَاثَةُ أَشْيَاءُ. And there are three things haram for someone who has minor religious impurity. So major religious impurity is janabah, is basically ejaculating or intercourse. And for the ladies, adding to that is, if you remember when we studied, is حَيْضٌ and nifas, meaning menstrual periods or bleeding after birth. Yes?
What's the proper way of
No, so water has to touch the whole body. Yeah. So what you do today is go home and then look at the lesson before this lesson. And because one of the chapter before this is explaining everything about ghusl. Right? So you go listen to all of that. And you still have questions, I'll answer it for you, inshallah. Because it goes into detail about like what are the obligatory actions of ghusl, what are the sunnah actions of ghusl, and how you lose, when you need to have ghusl and when you don't need to have ghusl. So look at that. If it's still not clear, then inshallah, I'll help you out, bi'idhnillah ta'ala. So three things are haram for you if you let out some air. Like there's three things you cannot do. Number one, obviously, salah. Right, and then tawaf because they're equivalent, right? وَمَسُّ الْمُصْحَفِ وَحَمْلُهُ, touching the mushaf and carrying it. So for the Shafi'iyya, if you don't have wudu, it is haram for you to touch the mushaf. They don't see it to be okay. They, most of them don't accept it even with a cloth or with something that's not attached to it, but they have different opinions. I believe that there's difference of opinion regarding that. Not in the madhahab, but outside of the madhahab, meaning the madhahab are pretty much stuck to that. Like Abu Hanifa, Malik, Shafi'i, and Ahmad, out of the reverence that they had for the Quran. This is a level of reverence and respect that they had for the Mus'haf that they wouldn't see it to be permissible for you to touch it, carry it, read it if you didn't have the proper purity that allows you to do it. And I think that's admirable, right? It's very admirable at a point of respect for the Quran. But from a jurisprudent point of view, and I believe that there are other opinions out there, and I tend to kind of side with them, especially if you're... if you're someone who needs to commute long for long times, like let's say you have to sit in a car or a bus and then go for like an hour, and you want to read the Quran and you don't have wudu, or it's hard for you to maintain your wudu for the whole time, especially you just wake up at 7 o'clock and you're eating food at night, so you're not going to be able to hold your wudu for too long, and you want to read the Quran. So this is I accept the bit more lenient opinion on it. Wallahu a'lam. And I think for the junub, no, you should get rid of your janabah before you touch the Quran. Wallahu a'lam. So I think that's more proper. Now again, yes.
Even if it's just on a table, you just want to move it.
Like, yeah. So even that they would take unless it was going to be it's going to fall to the ground or it's going to be mistreated. So this is what the opinions are regarding dealing with the mushaf for someone who has janab or someone who has minor religious impurities. Alright, so this is Kitab al-Tahara. This is the chapter of purities or purification. What we'll do next time, inshallah, is that I will do a quick review of everything that we covered. I'll write it down, inshallah, on the board. And I'll put a review of everything that we covered in the chapter of purification. And then, inshallah, after that, we'll move on to the second chapter. The second chapter is going to be salah. Now, this is important. If you're not come to this, this is very important. You will finally understand how to do salah within the understanding of one madhab properly, everything that they talk about. And I will do some comparative fiqh for you as well, because there are certain things that the scholars differ upon. And you'll see how there's more than one way to do things within salah itself. Any questions before we wrap up, inshallah? Yeah, go ahead.
About pigs and animals, some barbers use brushes that has boar bristles.
Bristles,
yeah.
Boar bristles, like
boar bristles in them. Really? The brush itself has boar bristles.
Or like toothbrush.
Yeah. Wow, really? Yeah. I no idea. Never heard that before. That's interesting. So you.
Or like the balls that have pig skin.
So here's what you're stuck with. So if you if it was tanned properly, if it was tanned properly, which they are. Most of the time the skin is taken and is tanned properly and it's dibagha, which we talked about at the beginning, it happens. So for the Hanafiya, right, and the Malikiya, this is tahir and this is no problem. And for the Shafi'iyya and the Hanabila, you're brushing your hair with najasa. And there's really no way around it. So it depends on what school of thought you're going to accept when it comes to that. I would again, this is why I think it's important for you to understand comparative fiqh a bit, specifically when you're living in a country, in Western countries, where a lot of the common, the popular culture, or just the basic norms of life, don't put in their consideration anything that is sacred or you know difficult or you know prickly for us. So we need to be able to access a lot of the fiqh, all the fiqh that exists and all the different opinions that are valid and are acceptable, and take those that are you know make our lives the easy you know more easier for us to live here. And I think for that, so I side to be honest with I side with the Hanafiya on the boars and dog thing. I believe that the body itself is not najis. I believe the saliva is, and my understanding of that being is that both pigs and dogs eat feces. They eat feces. They eat it. If you haven't seen it before, then please see it, because it'll make your day. Like, you'll enjoy seeing that. It'll be the funniest thing you see during that day. It's disgusting. They actually eat it. So their saliva, wallahu alam, is just not, it's not tahir because of the fact that they eat. Most other animals don't eat feces. They eat different types of meat. They eat different fruit, but they don't eat actual remnants feces of another another animal. So I kind of side with the Hanafiya specifically on that topic, because I believe that it's just doesn't make as much sense. So if a dog brushes up against me, I won't do anything. But if it licks my hand, I'll go and wash it out. Wallahu alam. Someone said something. Okay. So that's wallahu alam, the right way to, or not the right way. That's the way that I find to be easier. But again, you can, when it comes to these things, you can choose whatever you want to choose, and you have the right if there's bristle, you know, boar bristles in a. Yeah, you can ask them if you're stuck. Like, I don't want you want to take the more strict opinion or the more conservative opinion. Then ask them and tell them to use something else if there's a. But I personally don't see any problem. Wallahu ta'ala alam with that. Anything else?
I think it's the opinion of Sahih and the Maliki Madhab that tanning would work for any animal, because the hadith itself is saying it works for all animals.
For all animals,
make an exception for khanzir.
Exactly.
That we shouldn't.
The Maliki argument regarding boars and canines is very interesting and very intriguing. Meaning, they have a very, very strong argument. It's not a weak one. Like, yes, the majumhur don't take it. Yes, the majority of scholars don't see it. But when you listen to the Malikiyah's argument and they break down things, you will find it to be quite intriguing, quite interesting. So I don't think it's too foreign. And that's why I think I kind of, Hanafiya have it midway. Like, they kind of middle in between both opinions. So I find it to be the least, it makes life easier, I guess, to a certain extent, and they have good evidence to support it. Wallahu ta'ala alam. Okay, jazakumullah khair. Subhanakallah wa bihamdika, ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Barakallahu fikum wa atubu ilayk. We'll see you next week, inshallah.